parents, Walter Sue and Walter Lear, who have helped guide me in terms of a lot of the work I've done. I'm going to pick up where Joel left off. Can everybody hear me? I'd rather stand up, because I'm not sure that you can hear me. Can you hear me in the back? Okay. I'm going to pick up where Joel left off and sort of wrap that around with a little very brief history on the missing link between civil rights and health plan. Health planning really deals, and the bottom line of health planning is it decides where health care dollars go to improve the health care infrastructure. And so you'd logically think there would be a tie between Title VI that says that public dollars, federal dollars, cannot be allocated in a way that disadvantages minority groups. And since we now have county, federal, and state dollars, close to $1 trillion flowing into a predominantly private healthcare system, you would think there should be somebody kind of minding the store in terms of where this goes. And basically, we've had some kind of structure in place for a long time that tried to figure out how to allocate dollars at the local level to various providers in terms of improving their physical plants, adding new beds, and so forth like that. And for the first 50 years of our modern healthcare system, basically it was local private philanthropy and local public dollars that did that. And typically in communities, there was a voluntary agency that was put together to help advise private philanthropists and the public, the local municipality or the local county about how those dollars should be distributed to the healthcare system. In 1946, we had an interesting piece of legislation that was sort of cannibalized out of a national health insurance bill called Hill-Burton that basically allocated matching funds to the states and to local areas to provide capital for expansion of hospital beds, expansion of other types of services. And Hill-Burton, as I'll get into in a minute, had some interesting peculiarities, but that I have slammed in the past, but I'm beginning to appreciate that it really was the last kind of effort to try to provide some kind of intelligent allocation on the basis of need for the dollars going, the public dollars going into the healthcare system. We then went through a period of voluntary planning. We then went through a period of federally funded local planning that involved a certificate of need. And then in the mid-1980s, that died. And we've had basically private health systems doing their own planning based on their calculations of where the market is taking them in terms of their own interests, in terms of break-even. Let me talk a little bit about the Hill-Burton Act. Funds will be allocated to state plan that shall provide adequate health facilities without discrimination on account of race, creed, or color, but an exception shall be made in cases where separate hospital facilities are provided for separate population groups if the plan makes equitable provision on the basis of need for facilities and services of like quality for each group. Now, that's somewhat complicated, but basically says the South can have segregated facilities. They don't have to admit blacks to those facilities. But as I've learned, a lot of dollars actually were allocated to the development of black health system, and basically in many areas of the country, this did a tremendous amount of good in terms of providing access that had been lacking in the past to the hospital services for black communities. Okay, well, you know what this is all about. That's separate but equal. The great health planning contradiction in 1954, we had a little decision called Brown versus Board of Education that said you couldn't have separate but equal. And you had Hill-Burton that said you could for health care. And you had a little hospital, public hospital by the name of Grady being built that was it's still on the skyline of Atlanta that had two separate towers with identical emergency rooms, identical operating rooms, identical dining rooms, and one was for the black population of Atlanta, and one was the white population of Atlanta. That was supposed to be just when it was originally designed in 1949, 1950, was going to provide airtight protection against any legal challenges of the federal government that they weren't providing equal care to everybody. It was an incredibly costly building to construct. It's still a very costly building to renovate, and it's sort of a kind of case study of how you can't really have a cost-effective healthcare system if you have two separate systems, even if you try to make them equal, which in most cases nobody bothered. Okay, so that's just a great contradiction in 1954. It took 10 years to get the Brown decision applied to healthcare dollars. And basically that was a struggle that came out of one particular case, Simpkins, George Simpkins, a dentist in Greensboro, North Carolina, against Moses Cohen Hospital, and basically said if you are receiving Hill-Burton dollars for planning, state plan, local plan, and receiving public funds through that state plan, you are, in essence, an arm of the state. You are basically, even if you're a voluntary hospital, you're really a public institution. And the same things that apply to Grady Memorial Hospital, which was integrated much in advance of most of the voluntary hospitals in this country, because it was, in fact, a public institution, apply to you as well. That decision became Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. And it seemed, just as John Kennedy said when he introduced that bill in 63, that simple justice requires that taxpayers be treated equally, that tax dollars be treated equally. You can't subsidize with taxpayer dollars something that discriminates against taxpayers. Who could argue with that? Okay. Well, nobody believed that the application of Title VI to healthcare was really going to work. Well, we'd had a lot of experience with public schools in the South in terms of integrating them. There had been a tremendous amount of pushback, and so it wasn't going to work with the introduction of the Medicare program the year after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. And yet, peculiarly enough, maybe this sort of kind of plays into why healthcare has not had quite the attention that these other sectors did, because there was almost a quiet miracle that took place. And some people would, granted a very superficial quiet miracle, but in anyways, it was a miracle that in a few months, all the hospitals in this country, except for a couple of recalcitrant ones, which are interesting stories in themselves, integrated. That meant that everybody, all the floors were integrated, all the waiting rooms, and all the medical staffs had to be integrated as well. And there was a tremendous amount of effort and change in terms of doing that. Part of it was the insistence of one president that dug his heels in on this, which was LBJ, and said, that's what we're going to do with the Medicare program. I don't care what everybody's told me about healthcare being different. We're going to do it. And you had the other thing you had going for you is perhaps better than in any other sector of the country, the golden rule, those that have the gold rule. And if you wanted Medicare dollars, you had to keep the Office for Equal Health Opportunity happy because they certified you. And we got the Office of Equal Health Opportunity got volunteers from all through the bureaucracy of the federal government that were committed to civil rights and were willing to be transferred for this. And you also had volunteers in terms of local healthcare workers that would instruct the investigators where all the segregated accommodations were. And so there was virtually no possibility that any hospital could hide any kind of concrete physical structural kinds of discrimination in terms of how they treated their black patients, their white patients, their black workers, and their white workers. Okay, so I think there was a real lesson in this, that if you have a grassroots civil movement and you have real effort to provide accountability in terms of the use of public funds, you can see things happen very, very quickly. Okay, now that should have been a lesson for health plan. It should be intuitively obvious. If you got a healthcare system that is largely supported with federal dollars, and those dollars are shaped, and you have a structure that was put in place at the end of the 1960s, early in the 70s, that basically said you won't get any public dollars unless you comply with a certificate of need. It basically says you have to prove that your services are needed and you have to provide us with the information to do that. Now, obviously it would have made sense for these new health planning agencies to provide, to be the arm of the civil rights effort. I mean, they're basically making decisions about where federal dollars are flowing. They should be the ones that collect the information that Joel was talking about that the Office for Civil Rights has never been able to collect about disparate impact and all of those kinds of things. But basically what the local health system says, oh, we got enough on our plates dealing with all these hospitals that want new facilities. We're not going to take that on. And there was a little bit of a backlash that was created in the hospital industry that convinced Joe Califano, Secretary of HHS, to back off and say, okay, we're not going to insist that they become a part, an arm of the civil rights effort and in terms of certifying for compliance. Okay, well, CON basically died, at least in terms of federal support, in 1985, and we've gone through prospective payment and managed care and managed care shaping the planning of providers. And basically, the planning of providers is very simple. We've got to meet certain financial goals, or the cost of borrowing money is going to be too costly for us, or we may not even be able to acquire it at all. So every planning project has to return something to the bottom line. It's not a matter of need for the community. It's a matter of how can we keep this ship afloat and keep it expanding when we have all this other competition from other providers. So obviously, every healthcare provider, whether they want to or not, for a large extent, targets the private pay, more profitable procedures for expansion. In Philadelphia, we have a lot rather grotesque expansion of various kinds of diagnostic services and other kinds of services in the more affluent and predominantly white suburban areas. All the hospitals systems now have either planned or are in the process of constructing or have acquired facilities in the suburbs in order to do this. And those that need the care the most are getting sort of a little bit shortchanged. The ever result of all this is, of course, the disparities have been exacerbated, and you have higher costs, poorer quality care for everybody. You're duplicating services. Yes, there may be lots of open heart surgical procedure hospitals in the suburbs, but they're all very low volume. They're providing lousy quality. They're probably doing lots of unnecessary diagnostic procedures and all that kind of stuff. And so the white community as well as the black community is suffering not just in terms of quality of care, but also in terms of having to pay more for that care that they receive. Okay, well, come to the present. The great health planning contradiction now is that we have really widespread support in this country. Everybody, the Secretary of HHS, awarding hero medals to some of the people that I talk about in my book, said we're committed to eliminating health disparities. And there's really widespread support of that, Healthy People 210 goals, all the other kind of stuff, all the private insurance initiatives, all the public insurance initiatives have something to do about that. And yet, on the other hand, we have a wider market-driven planning that is increasing disparities, and non-discriminatory Title VI assurances given by hospitals and other providers are quite frankly fraudulent. And we might be able to sue them not under Title VI, but under the fraud and abuse legislation. So actually, one lawyer has actually proposed that. And one of the advantages of that is the lawyers actually get paid for bringing those kinds of suits. With those kinds of huge contradictions, I think there's always opportunities. And I'll stop there.
Beautiful.
Thank you.